Stuart, welcome to Waterstones.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
The last time I saw you actually was in a branch of Waterstones in Greenwich.
Yeah.
We filmed a shelfie video for your very first book.
Yeah.
And I remember you pitched it as Agatha Christie meets Groundhog Day with a bit of Quantum Leap body swapping thrown in.
Yeah.
Which I think still to this day is one of the greatest pitches I've ever heard for a book.
I think it's one of those pitches that is wonderful because it explains everything and nothing equally. That's why I always enjoyed that. Like the book itself, it's just kind of like...
In which case, for your new book, The Last Murder at the End of the World, what's your pitch for that?
See, I knew you'd do this. This is the difference between being a debut author and being an author who's three books in. Like, yeah. You don't have to do that anymore. Like, that pitch for Seven Deaths I had to come up with because I had to go to an agent, you had to take it to a publisher. You have to have a thing, right? Whereas this one, they were like, you're going to write another book? And I was like, yeah. What are you going to write? So I'll tell you in 2 years once we figured it out. This is about, I've sort of in my head pitched this as a utopian, dystopian crime novel. So it's about the world has ended. The world is over. It ended 90 years before the book starts. And almost everyone on the planet's been wiped out, apart from 122 people who were living on this like beautiful little island, right? So technology's basically been reset to almost zero. But they're having a wonderful life. They're having a really nice time. There's no violence on the island. There's no arguments. There's no nothing. They're having a perfectly lovely time. And then one of them turns up murdered. One of them turns up dead. And it's up to our little cast to work out who did that and why. Because again, there is no violence. There hasn't been a murder. There's no arguments. There's no reason for this thing to have happened. Mm. And then it sort of unfurls from there.
Unspurls?
Unspurls,
yeah. You're a writer. You're allowed to invent words.
Yeah, or just mash a few together or take some out of the lexicon.
Anybody who has read your previous book or indeed your two previous books, I think we'll pick it up and kind of go, oh, this is very different. And you seem to have done that with each book. You have decided to take your writing in a very different direction, which leads me, I suppose, to wonder, what is it that sort of spurs you and sort of inspires you when it comes to writing? Because it isn't so much genre.
Yeah.
It is far more, it seems to me, to do with storytelling and what gets your juices flowing. So tell me a little bit about that.
One word, boredom.
Okay.
Huge, huge quantities of boredom. Because there is nothing, I don't think, more boring than sitting at a screen for 8 hours a day. It's really, really difficult for my personality. My personality is about, like, we've just discovered that we live close to each other. We're surrounded by countryside. Like, I love that countryside. I'd be happily out there every day climbing the hills and going through the forests and all that sort of stuff. That's what I want to be doing. So for me to sit down in front of a computer every day and know that that project, that book, will not be done for 2 years, that's a big deal for me. It's a big commitment. So I've got to make sure that what I'm writing every single day is surprising me. I've got to make sure that it's entertaining me. I've got to make sure that I want to write it, that it's a writing challenge, or there's something every single day that keeps me going back to the computer. Because otherwise, I genuinely am a good enough procrastinator at this point that I would not go back for 3 months. Like, it'd be one day and then 3 months later. Yeah. And then, so the books, it's not so much about the genres and the storytelling, though that's a huge part of it. It's genuinely about coming up with a story where I'm like, I really want to write that. Mm. And I'm happy to spend 2 years doing it. And I'm happy to find the nuances in it. And I want broad enough canvases that I can just keep playing. So I'm like, this one is a bit of, you know, I said utopian, dystopian. It's a bit, there's a little bit sci-fi in there. There's a crime. There's definitely obviously crime and classic Christie stuff and Sherlock Holmes and stuff. And then there's a bunch of other bits in there. And I just got to play with all of that. Like, any given day, if I was a bit bored, I would just write a bit more of that and see where it took me. Mm. It's a lovely palette to give yourself.
I suppose one of the interesting things to start with this book is the narrative voice, which is very different to what people will be expecting. And in fact, it takes a while for the reader to work out who it is that's narrating. What can you tell us about that?
It's really difficult. This is a funny thing, right? So this happened with Seven Deaths as well. Basically, in my first novel, there's a Groundhog Day loop, right? So the character wakes up every day in the body of a different guest. I initially conceived of that as a surprise, right? It went straight on the blurb. The publishing put it straight on the back of the book. Everybody knew about it. It's the same with this one. Like, the reviews are all going to mention who the narrator is and what the narrator is about. I envisaged it being a surprise. Right. So I don't tell anybody for like 120 pages or something. Like, but you'll know by the time you get into the book. But I'll probably just keep it vague. But the narrator is something unexpected, something timely, I think, with a curious voice, because the narrator in this book is all at once very close to what everything that's happening and very distant, has a very different perspective on it all. And I really enjoyed writing that. I really enjoyed given myself, because it's the most authorial voice I've ever had in a book, if that makes sense. Because if you're in the first person, you're in their head. You're trying to convince somebody. You're trying to convince your reader that you are that character. With this, I don't have to do that. With this voice, it's removed enough that I can be an author about it, because these are just people I shuffle around in a book and I kill when I need to. I can be more authentic in this novel than I ever... I have to pretend to care in the other books, not in this one.
Was that narrative voice there from the very beginning, from the outset?
No, God, no.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
No, no, no. This book was an absolute nightmare. Yeah, yeah. It was conceived as something radically different, and that didn't work. And that was a really interesting thing to go through, because Seven Deaths, I knew what it was straight off the bat. Devil in the Dark Water took a little bit of getting to, but it's roughly what I conceived it to be. This novel was something else. It started off as something entirely different. And when that idea didn't work, and that took about a year for me, writing for about a year. There was almost a full novel, and it wasn't working. And that thing, that acid test we talked about earlier of, am I enjoying sitting down and working on this? And I really wasn't. And I was dragging myself to the computer every day, making myself miserable doing it. And eventually I just had to stop, walk away for a month and rip it apart and be like, right, what's not working? What don't I like? What's not? And everything was wrong with it. The plot, the ending, the main character had the wrong main character. Like, it was a really interesting exercise to dissect something that you've worked on and be like, right, what am I keeping? I must have kept like two elements and started again. So that's almost like an entirely new book from the book. But once that started happening, then it was a process of sort of like, it started off as a much broader thing, and I whittled it down until it was this and the things that I found interesting and important. But no, this was the one that's taken me the longest to dig out, if that makes sense.
It must be heartbreaking to do all of that work, as you say, to nearly be at the end of a book and to have to admit to yourself, this isn't working. I have to sketch it and start again.
Do you know what, mate? It's actually a bit of a release.
Yeah.
Because it's like, there's very few things in this world, if they're making you unhappy, you can just fix, right? Like, we all know unhappiness is a thing that you know, you go and get help with, or you have to work through, and there's steps, and there's like, you know, it's therapy, and there's bills, and there's all sorts of things. Not this. Like, I stopped, I ripped it apart, put it back together, and was like, I'm happy again now.
Right.
Like, there was literally, it wasn't as an easy process, but it was an obvious fix. And getting to the final novel wasn't like, oh, I've got my plan now, I'll get there. But every day I knew I was walking in the right direction. And after spending a year walking in the wrong direction, that's an incredible thing. Because again, I was trudging to my computer every day, knowing I had to do this, and it was hanging over me. And that's the way it felt, like I was being dragged to the bottom of the ocean. And it was making me miserable. I was miserable with my kids. I was miserable with my wife. I was miserable with my friends. And I couldn't explain it, because it's not that important. It's like, why are you so unhappy? And it's like, I'm just writing a bad book. And you don't. No author wants to write a bad book. And the problem is, you frequently can't see that. You don't. By the time you're a year into something, you don't often know whether it's good or bad. So that tells you how terrible it must have been, right? That I could obviously spot that it was awful. So no, when I fixed it, I was like, it was like dancing across clouds. It was so great. It was so great.
That's really interesting. You mentioned that some of those influences are science fiction-y.
Yeah.
And one phrase, I suppose, that people will know from the world of science fiction is this idea of world building, which is an incredibly important part of this book, because you are slowly revealing the world in which we are living. And it gets, I suppose, more and more complex the more you learn about what's going on. That presumably must have been an awful lot of work on your part. And were there sort of themes and ideas that helped you to build that world, because those were the things that you wanted to talk about in the plot of the novel? Or were you just sort of having fun creating something from scratch?
I think there's always a balance now in my books, because they're frequently described as cross-genre, right? Which I swear to God was a term someone just made up. They're like, what's this? Is it a crime book? Sort of. Like, it's a cross-genre book, all right, yeah. Like, it feels, it's a weird term, but what it applies for me is, I often feel like I'm like a stone skipping across the water, right? Like, I can go in any direction. Doesn't mean all those directions are right. So when I'm doing something like this that's got a bit of sci-fi, it's got a bit of crime, it's got a bit of fantasy, it's got a bit of a bunch of different things, like an apocalypse novel, it's about knowing the balance of those things. Like, I want it to be a crime novel first and foremost. I want it to read like a crime novel. I want it to obey most of the tropes of a crime novel, right? Because I like readers to get into a novel and be like, they can anchor themselves. Even if there's a lot of other stuff going on, they can be like, well, I know what I am. It's a crime novel. I know how this is going to work. And I try to always do that. Like, that is the thread, and then everything else is the pearls on that. So the world building, when I was doing that, it obviously wanted to push me super sci-fi because the world is set in the near future. I used to work on technology magazines. I used to be a technology journalist. So I had a fair idea of what the future world's going to look like in 100 years. I know what's been worked on. I know what's going to be the big things. And the urge was just to push that to its extreme and have all that stuff. And the more I did that, the more the novel wasn't familiar to the reader. Mm-hmm. Like, it felt very, I think it felt quite alien to them, which would have been fine if it's a pure sci-fi novel. It's not. Mm. It's a crime novel. So I had to pull that stuff back in. So when you talk about the Wilburton, it was a constant sense of, like, I want to create a near world that feels like it's got technology that's a little bit advanced from what we're on, but it's recognisable, that you feel comfortable with, you feel happy existing, but then stop at the point at which you're like, it feels fantastical. I might as well have just said there's a dragon in it now, right? Like, technology as fantasy, right? It's very easy to do. And the world came from that. The world came from those strictures. It came from me saying, these are my boundaries. This is the world I want. And obviously, I always write locked room, locked. So the first one was a locked house, second one was a locked boat. This is a locked island. Mm. There's always a closed-in environment that people can't get out of. So I had that to start with. I knew I had an island. I knew that the characters wouldn't go very far. I knew we had a fixed population. And the rest of it was just, what did the world look like beyond that? Mm. How much can I talk about? How much do I need to hint at? What's important to the story I'm telling? So that's always a really... And that came quite late, actually. Like, most of the plot was in, the characters was in. But getting that world and what people talked about and how they referred to it and how they felt about it, really tricky.
Mm. Equally tricky is talking about this book without spoiling it.
Yeah, no.
Anybody watching this interview is like, they're talking around it a lot.
But
we have to be very careful because I don't want to spoil it for anybody because that is the joy of reading the book.
The funny part is, I think it sounds like neither of us have read that. It's like, it sounds like I have not read this book either. They're like, he's doing that thing where he's never specific about anything.
Well, I've definitely read it and you definitely wrote it. So there are things we can say. I think one of the things that's really interesting about the book is, in terms of some of those themes and ideas, there is this, I guess, this discussion of some of the technology that you're talking about versus human nature.
Yeah.
And that one of the ideas is about trying to make humans better than they are, that there is this human instinct towards violence and domination that has been their undoing. Mm-hmm. And the question would be, what if you could fix that?
Yeah.
Of course, one of the ways you could fix that is through artificial intelligence, which, of course, everybody is talking about right now. Mm-hmm. That is a sort of, not an either-or, but it's a, you know, a debate that's going on. How do you feel about that debate? What are the, I suppose, the dangers of something like artificial intelligence, even against something as dangerous as a human being and its propensity for violence?
I think the artificial intelligence debate is astonishingly funny to me because it's one of those things where, like, everyone's like, artificial intelligence, we've got to do something. It's like, it's too late. Like, we know as a species that if we get to the point where we create a learning artificial intelligence, a truly learning, not like an algorithm doing something that looks human, something that truly can learn, it will learn everything there is to know in about 2 milliseconds. It will, whatever prism we've created for it, it's infinitely smart, and it will be out and it'll be gone. The moment we'll know that we've created a learning algorithm is 10 seconds before it kills us all. Like, it'll just spread and it'll be gone and it'll be over. So that genie's out the bottle. That's happened, right? Like, that's going to be created somewhere. It's either going to be created by a Mark Zuckerberg in a lab somewhere, or it's going to be created in a military base. Like, there's nothing we can do about it. So worrying about it coming and taking our jobs, yeah, okay, let's do that. But, like, we'll be dead 10 years after that. So probably... It's one of those things. So when we're talking about it, what I'm talking about is a more optimistic view of it, about a species, and that is the most fantastical part of the novel, I think, that they have created something. They have created an artificial intelligence. They did do it, and it worked, and it didn't immediately kill everybody. Like, it lived in harmony. We bent it to our will, and we had ideas for it. We had optimistic aspirations for it. The problem with that is, if you just look at humanity anywhere in the world, it doesn't matter what you tell a human to do, right? Like, hey, look, there's a massive pandemic going around the world, but just take this vaccine and you'll be fine. No. Why? Like, oh, because, like, it's a conspiracy. It's any level that you ask any human being to do, almost anything, a huge percentage of our population will say no, for no other reason than that you've asked them to do it. So, if you're talking about getting an artificial intelligence and going through the steps of using that to make our world better, it will never happen because we will not allow ourselves to be controlled. Like, and that sounds like an awesome John Carpenter movie, but it's actually dreadful, and it will destroy us as a species if the artificial intelligence doesn't get us first. We can't take steps to save ourselves. We can't take obvious steps to do what needs to be done. It makes no sense to me at all. Like, if you just, everyone in this room, if you just sat us down and were like, hey, look, do you know what? Like, probably meat consumption way down, sort of like, you probably can't do this, this, and too much, and maybe get rid of those plastic bags. And how about if you just convert? And everyone would be like, oh, yeah, it's a great idea. And then you get to 100 people, it's like, no, 50% of them will not do it. Yeah. It's bonkers. It's just bonkers.
Before we get too hopeless in our
I started that way. I was born, I'm from the Northwest. That's how we start.
You mentioned, obviously, that this novel has a sort of utopian community, if you like, where there is no violence and people are very happy. And that means that when they're shocked by this event, they're not very well suited to dealing with it, except that there is one person in this community who perhaps more than any of the others has an inquisitive and questioning nature, which is Emery. Can you tell us a little bit about creating that character and what makes them so special?
Oh, it was delightful. It was absolutely delightful because I was trying to write a murder mystery. I never realised this before. It's honestly a question that never popped up in my head. I was trying to write a murder mystery where everyone's innocent, like, which is really hard to do because everyone in this society, all 122 people, are sweet, are kind, are good-natured, they get along, they help each other. They're everything I'd love the human race to be. It's a really hard place to put a murder mystery. It seemed like a really good idea in my head. Like, what if you had a murder mystery where everyone was completely innocent, right? Or everyone looked completely innocent. What would you do? Because the standard murder mystery trope, right, is to have, well, that person's suspicious for that reason, and that person's suspicious. You just dig into all the suspicious things that eventually you get. And the idea is that they're all guilty of something, but not the thing that you're looking for. And I've written that novel before. It's great. Whereas this is the opposite. Like, they're all almost completely clean, and you've got to sort of work out like what's churning around inside of them. Emery was the opposite. Like, Emery, I think in any other novel, is the suspicious one because she doesn't display the same characteristics as everyone else. She is suspicious, like, of other people. She asks questions. Nobody else asks questions. And so there are odd things going on the island. There's strange things, and she wants to know about them. She's pushing against the boundaries constantly. But she's still sweet, she's still innocent, she's still a little bit naive. Like, it was a really fun combination. And she obviously only exists because you need a detective. You can't have one of these novels without a character who is the detective. And you need somebody, it's part of the genre. They almost need to be outside of society. Like, whatever the society is, the detective somehow needs to be a little bit apart from it. It's always the key. And I initially didn't want to do that. I wanted her to be, like, raised up amongst them almost unwillingly. And it didn't work either. She had to stand apart. It just goes to show how many of those tropes are there because they've proven to be the best way of doing it. And she's one of them. But yeah, she was a joy. Yeah, she was so much fun.
You were talking earlier about your daughter, and there was something about Emery which feels to me very much like all daughters.
Yeah.
in that sort of, as I say, that sort of questioning, inquisitive nature, that will see the things that other kids don't sometimes.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether there was any element of sort of inspiration from your own family for some of her characters.
Of course, but it's more like, once you've got kids, you are entirely rewired as a human being, right? My entire perception of the world is completely different to how it was before they were born. Not for better, not for worse, just very, very different. And I've noticed it in my writing. My first book was written before my daughter was born. Second one was written during, so like first half of it almost completely coincides with her, my wife being pregnant, and the second half is her being born. There's two kids in Devil. They were supposed to die. She was born, they lived, right? And that is, there's no purer distillation of what's happened to me. So, like, yeah, right, when I start now writing more innocent characters, I automatically write them a little bit more childlike, or with that sort of childlike view of the world, which is, there are no bad questions. There's no embarrassing question. You just walk straight up to a person. We had, and I hope he doesn't mind this, like, we had a friend round who's recently split up with his partner. And my daughter, she's 5. She's only ever been used to seeing both of them come together, my friend and his partner. So, you know, he walks in, comes in by himself, and she's just like, where's Alex? And he has to be like, oh, you know, split up. And then my daughter's like, I don't understand, where is he? Like, you know, is he coming later? It just carried on going. And any adult would have been like, because we're in the corner being like, how do we stop this? Like, what do we do? But she just kept going and going and going. And I think he found it quite refreshing. It was just like, oh, it's this and this reason. And it was, you know, it's okay, it's fine. And she still didn't understand it.
Yeah.
But I like that. I like that relentlessness of it and the innocence of it, and the sense that, like, all she's interested in Not even the answer is the understanding. Like, the answers often don't lead to understanding. She wants to understand, and she keeps going around trying to find new ways in. So I was really trying to capture that with Emery. I really wanted that sort of... You could imagine her in the room pestering you with questions. It would take a long time before she really bothered you. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You would find yourself like being kind of amused by it, and I really wanted that sense with her in this.
And there are three characters. You mentioned sort of there are the villagers in this book, and then there are these three elders who are sort of a level above, if you like, the rest of the villagers. Tell me a bit about creating them as characters, and I suppose there's an element of knowledge that they have about the world which the others don't share. And so is that about that kind of thing of keeping secrets from others?
I think with them, the idea was that if you're writing a book, again, set 90 years after the end of the world, so the elders are the last people before the world ended. So they were still alive then, so they saw the world end, whereas everybody else has been born on the island, right? So the elder characters, I wanted to talk about the world before. I didn't want it to be a completely fresh slate. I didn't want to just have 122 people who'd heard stories about the past. I wanted people who'd experienced it. Because then I can do juicy things, like I can talk about the apocalypse, I can talk about how the world ended, I can have scenario people having nightmares about what happened in that. And I can, again, we talk about technology, they can miss things. There's something juicy about that. Like, imagine the world we have now with all its problems, but swipe all that technology away and start us again tomorrow and think about what you'd miss. And I don't think it'd be the obvious things like, you know, me or or cameras. I think it would be like, for me, it would be things like coffee. It would just be like an easy to get coffee on a street or like, so I had that with these characters. I wanted people who were more familiar to us, who would like, you can sort of recognize yourself in that person and still had quite old world values, shall we say, sort of still thought about the world the way we think about the world, whereas the new generation very much don't. As I said, they don't argue, they never fight, they're very pure, they're very beautiful, but because of that, they're almost completely alien to us. They're almost like, from our perspective, they feel a world away, whereas it's their world, right? Like, this is the world, and those guys are the ones who feel a little bit strange, but revered because they've got all this knowledge. So I really like that. And again, we go back to the idea of, like, I want to entertain myself while I'm writing. That's what allows me to do that. Having those characters interact in strange ways and not get each other and have awkward conversations. I love that stuff.
We were talking earlier about our slightly hopeless view of the future when it comes to human nature.
Slightly hopeless. Yeah, completely and utterly hopeless of the future.
But I would say that actually this book is quite hopeful about the future. Is it that way because it's only in fiction that you could express some of that sort of positivity and hope, or is there an element of you that is hopeful about where we might head?
I think there's got to be an element because I wouldn't keep having children. Like, we've just had another daughter, she's 7 months old.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It doesn't feel like a congratulations moment at the moment when she's not sleeping through the night, but yes. So there's got to be a little flicker of hope in me, otherwise I wouldn't keep birthing children into this world, right? But I think the signs are not great. Like, and I'm usually quite a rational, logical fellow. And if I sort of look at the world, what I'm waiting for now is a miracle, like a scientific miracle, like somebody to create something tomorrow that fixes everything. That's sort of what we need, because we're increasingly showing ourselves as a species that we just keep making terrible decisions. And that's not something that seems fixable at the moment. So when I'm writing, I don't want to write that. And also, when I started writing this, we'd all just come out of the pandemic. And I didn't want to thrust people back into that sort of misery. I didn't want people to feel that sort of sense of, like, hopelessness and despair that we all felt. And especially when we went into that second lockdown and it was like, oh my God, this is never going to end. Or if we lost loved ones and this thing that we couldn't do anything about. I didn't want that again. I didn't want people to have to experience that again. I want joy. I want hope. I want positivity. I want a goal. Like, again, if you have a murder mystery novel, the point is you solve the murder, and then you get some closure at the end of it. And this one's got even bigger stakes than that. You've got to feel that there's some reason for doing it. Like, I wrote my hopeless novel. My first book was the most hopeless thing I'll ever write. This one is a bit more positive.
And you seem pretty fearless when it comes to thinking about what you might write next. And as we've said, that there's always been these big changes from one book to the next. Have you already started work on the next one, or are you very much focused on publicising this one first?
No, I've started work on it. So I've started thinking about it, which is quite a big deal for me. Because usually I need it to rattle around in my head for 6 months. And actually just a couple of months ago, no, probably less than that, I realised that what I've been doing was wrong. which is quite a nice thing to get to before a year into the writing. So I realised I was making some old mistakes. The scope was too grand and the characters were too vague. And so I've trimmed it back down and started thinking about a new and a different angle. So that's where I'm at with that. And it's a really nice place to be, because it means when I start writing a book, it's all consuming. Mm. And it's very annoying for everyone around me, because you're only ever half listening to people. You're always like, it's like having a song in your head all the time. And this book and these problems you're trying to solve. And like, as my wife likes to say, just go away, you're not present anyway. So she'll just send me back. Like, but at this point, I'm kind of free of it. Like, I'm very light and loose and happy. But when I start writing, when I put that first line down a minute then, and again, like 90% of me will be a book and 10% will be Stu just walking around smiling emptily at people in my life.
Well, we obviously wish you the very best with that
process. Thank you very much.
But it's really great to speak to you about this book. I think we should give ourselves a pat on the back for not having really spoiled any element of the plot somehow.
I don't know how we've done that. Well, that's amazing.
Because we're both very excellent at skirting around the topic. But it's a real pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.